Miff Warhurst.
Weekdays on ABC Radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
It's been nearly 60 years since the international world of academia was rocked by the Harvard Psilocybin Project, which was an experimentation with LSD, which led to the dismissal of Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert and launched the psychedelic countercultural movement / revolution. Now the study of psychedelics is considered to be far more respectable, with growing evidence that microdosing might actually be good for you. In his latest book, How to Change Your Mind, science journalist Michael Pollan encourages us to look beyond our misconceptions and understand the potential of hallucinogens for healing. And he joins me right now. Hello.
Hello, Meph. Good to be here.
Good to be here too with you. Michael, now, your previous area of expertise was food, and I feel like we should believe you when it comes to your scientific research, because you came up with so many of those well-known terms that we now use on a daily basis. Things like eat real food, not too much, mostly plants. That was yours.
Yes,
we now
my
know
haiku.
We now know that to be true. And the other one was the whiter the bread, the sooner you'll be dead.
Yes.
We now know that to be true. I'm wondering, why did you turn your attention from food and the production of food and the way we consume food to something else entirely, psychedelic drugs?
It is a bit of a departure in some ways, but in my mind, they're of a piece. I'm very interested in our engagement with the natural world and how the things we take into our bodies changes us. And certainly that's food, but it's also plant, you know, psychoactive plants and mushrooms like psilocybin. And I'm very interested in health. And a lot of my work about food was about our physical health. And now my interest is moving to mental health. And that's how psychedelics are being used, actually, is as a therapeutic treatment. And when I started learning about it and started interviewing people who'd had these powerfully transformative experiences that helped them cure an addiction or remove, in the case of terminal cancer patients, remove their fear of death, I thought, well, this is extraordinary. I need to look at that, because I shared most of the misconceptions about psychedelics. You know, like most people, I thought they're a product of the 60s. They begin with Timothy Leary, and they led to all sorts of disruptions in society. And they had some positive effects too in the counterculture. But I did not know that for 20 years before the 60s, they had been used in a very serious, responsible way by academic researchers, psychiatrists, as a treatment, and that there had been this really vibrant period of research that stopped with the counterculture. So there's a lot I realized we don't know that I needed to explore.
So there's so much more than turn on, tune in, drop out, which is the catchphrase of that time, the countercultural
revolution.
That was
Timothy Leary's phrase, and it scared the hell out of adults.
It did.
The government, and really led to the kind of moral panic that engulfed psychedelics and then shut down the research.
Let's talk about the research. What were they treating? What sorts of conditions? And how did the psilocybins help in the treatment?
So psilocybin is the chemical in magic mushrooms. It's very closely related to LSD. It doesn't last quite as long, but basically has the same effects and affects the same neurotransmitter network in the brain. And when these drugs were introduced, really beginning in the early 50s, when psychiatrists start looking at them, they didn't know what they were good for, if anything. They knew they had these powerful psychoactive effects. And at first they thought they mimicked psychosis, because it sure looked like psychosis. People were seeing things that weren't there. Their sense of personality was dissolving. So it looked like they made you crazy. And they studied them as a means of understanding schizophrenia. And they realized that wasn't really right. And then they began treating a range of things. Alcoholism was a very successful treatment in the 50s, using LSD or psilocybin to treat addiction, which sounds like a weird idea to use a drug to treat a drug addiction. But in fact, what they found happened is that people had a very powerful, almost spiritual experience that allowed them to reconnect with nature, with the people in their lives. Because if you think about it, addiction is really about disconnection. Mm. You're losing your connection to your community or your family, and you're connecting to this chemical, to this bottle. And people will give up their everything for this bottle. That relationship becomes the most important. So it kind of breaks those destructive habits. And when I say that, what's really incredible is it's only a single psychedelic experience can have this effect of breaking an addiction.
Can I ask how?
Yeah, you can ask how. The scientists want to know how, too.
Yeah.
We don't know for sure exactly what the mechanism is. We know, though, it appears to be the psychedelic experience, not a drug effect. In other words, you are having such a transformative experience that's characterized very often by a loss of a sense of ego. This sense of this voice that you think is directing your life and chattering at you and telling you what to do goes away. And you get this kind of it almost defrags the brain because it's the ego that tells these destructive stories about yourself that I can't get through the day without another drink. I'm unworthy of love. I'm a worthless human being. Those stories which we tell ourselves about ourselves are very destructive. And the mechanism that's doing that is turned off for a period of time. Something called the default mode network, which is very important brain network tied to your sense of self. It's where we go for self-reflection, mind wandering, time travel. If the ego has an address in the brain, it's in the default mode network. And that network is temporarily silenced. And that appears to free the brain and the mind from these destructive habits.
Michael Pollan is with us here on ABC Radio, and we are talking about his new field of research as a science journalist. It is, will we use
psychedelic science?
Psychedelic science. That's,
yeah,
that's a great term for
and
it.
And psychedelic therapy.
Yeah.
And it's important to understand, too, that the way psychedelics are being used in this research therapeutic context is very different than the way they're used recreationally. This is not taking a pill and going to a concert or taking a walk in the woods. You are with a guide, two guides actually, the entire time, trained therapists who prepare you very carefully for what's about to happen, tell you what to do if something scary happens, which can happen. The trips can be very disturbing.
Well, that's what I was going to ask as well. If anyone has experimented a bit, but it's been well documented, these things don't always go well for the user.
No, people have bad trips, as they're called, although the therapist would call them challenging trips because they actually can be very useful in if you're in the right psychotherapy context. The main piece of advice they give you before you start, though, is to surrender to whatever is happening in your mind. A lot of bad trips happen because you're resisting something that seems really scary. You see a monster or you see your sense of self dissolving, and you fight to hold on to that sense of self. That's when you get really anxious and terrified. Their advice is trust and let go, or quoting John Lennon, relax your mind and float downstream. You just have to go with the experience, and if you do, it will be much happier. So that's really key advice. And then during the experience, these therapists sit with you the whole time. They're there, available to give you a helping hand. They don't say very much, but you're not alone. And I think that that gives you the freedom that someone's looking out for your body so your mind can travel.
In a way, is this treatment then harking back to some of the ancient rituals that were wrapped around, say, certain psychedelic drugs like ayahuasca?
Ayahuasca. Yeah, it is a kind of shamanic. I mean, the scientists would hate for me to use this word, but it has a lot of shamanic elements. Because as in the case of shamanism, whether it's ayahuasca or psilocybin, which was used shamanically in Central America and Mexico for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, there is an elder who knows the territory, who's supervising the experience and making people feel like it's under control. And also the expectations shape the experience, as with shamanism. There's a very powerful element of suggestion that if I tell you you're going to have a certain kind of experience on this drug, you're much more likely to have it. The doctor slash shaman is kind of preparing the ground for a positive healing experience. You also set an intention. I want to deal with my addiction to cigarettes. I want to deal with my fear of death. I want to deal with my childhood trauma, whatever it is. And that's also very important to get clear on your intention. So that's another way in which this therapeutic use is not like the recreational use, which, you know, the intention there is thrill-seeking, basically.
Michael Pollan, something I've observed about your work is that you put yourself
always
in the work. You, when it comes to your food documentaries and your food writings, you've killed the animals, you've eaten the animals to respect the animal, to learn about the process. I am assuming as part of this research that you've done for your latest book, How to Change Your Mind, talking about the therapeutic advantages of psychedelic science, How did you put yourself into this?
Well, I realized I couldn't write this book without having these experiences myself. And I hadn't had them as at the age-appropriate stage of life in my 20s. And I didn't really have a big psychedelic experience till I was nearing 60. But I think my readers kind of expect that kind of immersion journalism that I
of
do.
Course.
And I also think there's information you get from doing something yourself that you can get no other way. So I had a series of guided psychedelic experiences, one on LSD, a couple on psilocybin, one on a very weird drug called 5-MeO-DMT, which I wouldn't recommend to anybody, and one on a couple on ayahuasca, and wrote about it. And they were some of the most interesting experiences of my life, I have to say. I had a high-dose guided psilocybin trip in which I actually saw my sense of self explode in a little cloud of Post-it notes and then liquefy. And I was like a coat of paint spread out on the ground. And it was fine. And I observed this scene from some new perspective that I had never experienced before. I don't know what it was, a kind of disembodied awareness. And it made me realize, oh, I'm not identical to my ego, which is actually a very liberating thing to learn. We assume this voice in our head is us, but it isn't actually. And I found that incredibly freeing. So that was after that, I had this one thing that happens on psychedelics is that people's sense of separateness disappears and they feel more interconnected than they ever have, whether it's to nature or other people. People commonly report this powerful surge of love for other people. And in my case, I had a experience of merging with a piece of music. I was listening. Music is very powerful on psychedelics. And I was listening to one of Bach's unaccompanied cello suites performed by Yo-Yo Ma. And I can't say I listened to it because that implies a subject and an object. I became it. I became identical with this piece of music. And I heard it as deeply as I have ever heard a piece of music. And it wasn't necessarily a happy experience. It's a very sad piece of music. You've heard it at funerals. But I was one with it. And that was just overwhelmingly powerful and beautiful experience that I'd never had before.
It's something that probably most of us won't try in our lifetime under medical supervision.
Well, it's coming to Australia. It's important to understand. The first trial of psilocybin to treat cancer patients is going to begin in Victoria, I think in September, and at St. Vincent's Hospital. And there is a move afoot as it becomes approved in the United States, which is expected to happen in the next 5 years, to do that here as well. So it may be sooner than you think.
How would psilocybin treat cancer?
It doesn't treat the cancer. It treats the fear and depression of the cancer. And, you know, we have very little to treat to give terminal patients. We give them morphine, which essentially dulls – it deals with the pain, but it dulls their minds as they die. This sharpens the mind. It has the opposite effect. And I interviewed many people who are dying of cancer who had these transformative experiences. And in many cases, they completely lost their fear of death. It was the most uncanny thing. And I think that had to do with this dissolution of self. It's kind of a rehearsal for death. You see your sense of self disappear and you realize something survives you. And many of the patients I talked to had that sense that although their bodies might die, something of them will survive. And that might have been nature, their family. Basically, Bertrand Russell said this a long time ago, that the way to die without fear is to expand yourself, your sense of self, beyond your body, this bag of bones, to your family, your offspring, your community, the natural world. And to the extent you can expand that, it's less frightening to die. And I think that's kind of what's happening with the people on psychedelics.
Michael Pollan, you've given us a whole lot of ideas to search through ourselves and perhaps make our own decisions. Probably the best way we can do that is to have a read of your book, How to Change Your Mind. As you walk away from this project, what have you learnt about yourself?
Well, I think the big takeaway about myself was that I'm not necessarily identical to my ego, that the ego tells us some pretty destructive stories about ourselves.
I was going to say, why do we need to see ourselves as
an ego?
As apart from our ego. How is that the self-destructive element?
Well, egos have a lot of there's a reason egos evolve. They're very good for getting things done. They're very good for, all the things that natural selection wants us to do, right? Finding a mate, succeeding, surviving. They're great at that. But they also get overactive, hyperactive in some people, and they become very punishing. In depression, it really is the ego that's punishing people, telling you, negative stories about yourself. Like all things, it's a mixed bag. And for some people, the ego, especially later in life, enforces bad habits of thought and behavior. So breaking its hold can be useful, and to realize it is a tool, but I don't have to listen to it all the time. So that's been very useful. I mean, if you ask my wife, she would say the lasting effects have been a greater openness and patience than I was known for before. And she also said it was something very interesting because I asked her this question because a lot of journalists like you asked me it. She said, I think you dealt with your father's death very differently than you would have. My dad died a year ago in January.
Sorry.
And I was with him for the last 10 days. I moved into their apartment. I was very present. I wanted to be with him. I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to hold him. And I was open to the experience. And, one of the things the ego protects us against is death. Right? And it finds many ways for us not to deal with death. I'm a busy person. I could have found excuses not to be so present, but I didn't want to be. I really wanted to be there. And I attribute that to these experiences.
Michael Pollan is a journalist, science journalist, if you've just tuned in, and we are talking about psychedelic science. Harking back to Timothy Leary and also Richard Alpert, who were kicked out of
Harvard
for doing their research on psychedelics. Were they on the right track back then in the 1960s?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, Leary and Alpert were, as happens to a lot of people get involved with psychedelics, they get a little overenthusiastic. There's a kind of irrational exuberance that you feel like you found the key to solving world peace and dealing with the problems of humanity. And so I think that they got to a point where they got impatient with science and just wanted everybody to turn on, hence turn on, tune in, and drop out. And this was not a good look for science.
Yeah.
And so they got sloppy and they began – their research was sloppy and they began giving the drugs to undergraduates, which they were supposed to not do. Remember, it was legal at the time, but still they weren't supposed to give them to undergraduates. And I think a lot of the other researchers who were a lot more serious at the time were scandalized by what they were doing. And they actually tried to get Leary to just cool it because there was really useful work. And it's a tragedy that we lost 30 years of research. I mean, we would have already have developed a very important, potent tool to deal with mental health problems. I think it's important the context of this right now. We have a mental health crisis worldwide. The rates of depression are very high. The WHO recently said that depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide. Rates of suicide, I know in the United States, are soaring, and anxiety, I mean, we have just lots of mental health problems. And the mental health treatment we have is totally inadequate to the problem. I mean, if you compare mental health treatment with any other branch of medicine, it has achieved very, very little. It doesn't achieve cures. It basically deals with symptoms. And it hasn't increased life expectancy or significantly reduced human suffering. And I think most psychiatrists would admit this. And that's one of the reasons that there is this, I found, a surprising openness to explore these new areas that pretend potentially a revolution in mental health care. Here would be a drug you take once under this close supervision that in two-thirds of the cases leads to one of these powerful experiences that can help you break an addiction, relieve a depression, and help you deal with your fear of death. That's quite extraordinary. I don't know of another tool like that. Now, the research needs to be completed. We need larger trials with bigger groups. There's often enthusiasm at the beginning of a new drug, as there was with the antidepressants. But the antidepressants are fading in their value. People don't like taking them. You have to take them every day for the rest of your life. Over time, they don't work as well. And they're addictive. Compare that to psychedelics, which are non-addictive, not toxic to the body, in the case of psilocybin and LSD. They have to be done in this very carefully controlled environment, and that's a lot of therapist time. On the other hand, you may only have to do it once.
So there's no suggestion that you should just go and try it yourself.
No. It's very important to make that distinction between the recreational use, which, you know, works out fine for some people. But people have really bad experiences. People have bad trips. Psychotic breaks have been known to happen. That's a real phenomenon. There have been some suicides on psychedelics. Of course, there are a lot of suicides on antidepressants also, and that doesn't get in the newspapers. But it's a momentous thing to do. It has to be approached with a sense of intention and seriousness and in a very safe environment. You're not going to allow your ego to dissolve if you're at a party. And in fact, that could be a very anxiety-provoking experience.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating topic, psychedelic science. Just quickly, in America, as always, it's a little bit further in front than perhaps we are here in Australia. I have been reading about a lot of people who are microdosing psychedelic.
Microdosing is a big fad, especially in Silicon Valley, but around the country in general. And that is the taking of a small amount, like a tenth of a dose of either psilocybin or LSD every third or fourth day. It's an interesting idea. People report positive effects on their mood, their creativity, their productivity. But it's important to point out that we have no research yet. They have not done the controlled double-blind trial to see, is that a placebo effect or is that a real effect? Now, for some people, it may not matter. I mean, placebos work in a way. But scientifically, it's important to understand what is going on. I'm not convinced there's anything there yet. There are a lot of reports, a lot of anecdote. But one of the key facts about psychedelics is that expectation shapes the experience to a powerful degree. They're kind of like placebos on rocket boosters. So if you start taking psilocybin every day because someone's told you you're going to be happier, you probably will be happier. But does it have anything to do with the drug? And that's the question we still need to answer.
You've given us so much to think about today, Michael Pollan. It's wonderful to meet you and hear your thoughts on this.
Thank
as
you,
well.
Matt. It's great to be here.
Science journalist Michael Pollan there, and his latest book is called How to Change Your Mind.